This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Bill Hammack. Today, I'll be talking about how movie tie-ins and the electronic revolution in movie making and viewing has changed filmmaking. Now, to us as consumers, advances like DVDs seem simply to make it easier to view movies, and most movie tie-ins seem superfluous. Yet they also shape the movies we see. And to explore this, we'll look at a very detailed case study, the production and merchandising of the movie trilogy, Lord of the Rings. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine, Kristen Thompson.
Good afternoon, Bill. It's good to be here.
Hello, Kristen. Well, I want to start with the franchise a little bit. I mean, you note that The Lord of the Rings is, quoting you now, far more than a movie. And what do you mean by this?
Well, I think everybody's aware that there are these products that come out at the same time as the films, and we see them in the stores and so forth. But I think a lot of people don't realize how many, many products and other linked programs and so forth come out of a single huge, huge film project like Lord of the Rings. The video games, the DVDs, as you mentioned. I think there are over 400 licensed products now for Lord of the Rings, so it's a big business, and it's still going on. There are still products coming out.
So give me a sense of the value of this activity for Lord of the Rings. I mean, the movie gross for the trilogy was some $3 billion, if I remember correctly, but surely that's the major chunk of change, right?
It is probably the single biggest, but on the other hand, in some cases, DVDs do make as much money as the theatrical release of films, and of course, so far, New Line has put out 3 sets of DVDs for these films, and I suspect in the future we'll probably see a re-release and so on. But yeah, the $3 billion is a good start.
So, but what do you think is the total? I mean, a very rough estimate of that.
It's very difficult to judge, but if you figure that the DVDs and video games quite possibly will make that much in and themselves.
You mean $3 billion?
Mm-hmm. $3 billion, yeah. And the licensed products certainly have gone over $1 billion by now. So I would think possibly $10 billion or more.
$10 billion. So $3 billion for the DVD and the video games and licensed products around $1 billion. So this is a huge, huge franchise. Let's look at some of the ways that the creators built that franchise very intentionally when they made the movie. So let's start with some of the elements of the film itself. Now, to be successful, New Line Cinemas and the director Peter Jackson had to first make it appeal to core Tolkien readers, but then broaden its appeal to people who were likely never to read the books. And one of the things they did was link certain characters to genre conventions of films. Can you give us an example of some of these genre conventions and things they did?
Well, I think the most obvious thing is the whole business of Legolas acting somewhat like Bruce Lee when he's fighting. You get a lot of martial arts conventions in the swordplay and just the hand-to-hand fighting in this film. So that, I think, is perhaps one of the most obvious ones. But Peter Jackson is a horror film director, and you get things like The Dead Marshes, where Frodo falls in the water and suddenly he's looking at these faces that are straight out of some horror film. So horror and martial arts, I think, probably most obviously, but romance, clearly, war films, even westerns in some cases. Some of the imagery would invoke the wide open plains and riders and so on.
So the goal here was to introduce imagery and conventions that people would normally understand. I mean, I think Legolas was based on Bruce Lee, Fist of the Fury, some of his fight scenes. Is that correct?
I think he's pretty obviously imitating martial arts. He, at one point, refers to himself as Kung Fu Elf in one of the interviews. So, yeah, this is a conscious thing they're doing.
So this is something they had to do to broaden the appeal to people who were not devotees of the books, but they also had a responsibility to fans and to those that regard making the movies as, I'll say, a privilege for a filmmaker. Now, Peter Jackson, had an obligation to not modify the books, but needed to. So what did he do to bring this core group on board with the movie?
Well, I think there were 2 main strategies that I talk about in the book. One of them is the design. I mean, everyone who sees this film, whether they love it or hate it, will say that the design is fantastic and that it looks like Middle Earth. You know, the descriptions of Tolkien seem to come to life on the screen, and New Zealand is the perfect place to represent Middle Earth and so forth. Mm-hmm. So that was a big start, I think. And one thing that they did early on was to bring aboard Alan Lee and John Howe, who were two of the most famous Tolkien illustrators. They had done calendars and book covers and so forth.
These are people
and
that would appeal to fans.
And would recognize their work.
Okay.
So they did thousands and thousands of sketches and paintings, which were then used as a sort of model by all the designers on the film. And they would all meet together with Lee and Howe to make sure that everything was working together in a unified fashion. So ultimately you get a world on the screen that looks very much like Middle-earth and will have that familiarity, even if some of the events that are taking place there are quite different from what happens in the book. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing was Peter Jackson's really quite brilliant use of the Internet. He's a fan himself. He declares that, I made this film, you know, I'm a fan, I made it for fans. And he also knew how to talk to fans. I mean, early on, he was looked upon with a great deal of skepticism by people who knew his work. Most people, I think, when the film project was announced, had never heard of him. But those who had often knew him through his early, you know, sort of comic splatter films like Bad Taste and Brain Dead. So, you know, they thought, how can this guy turn around and make Lord of the Rings, this wonderful epic, you know, it's supposed to be sort of dignified and treated with respect. So he was facing opposition from the fan group to begin with. And what he did was go on the Internet. He went on one of the biggest pop culture sites, Ain't It Cool News, and he invited fans to send in questions that he would answer online. And this was just a few days after New Line announced that they had taken on this project. So, of course, thousands of fans wrote in. He answered some of the more interesting or more commonly asked questions, and the fans loved it. They ate it up. And he did that a number of other times, making sort of direct contact with fans. And now this is such a common ploy for film directors to, you know, go on some kind of a website and talk to fans or go to Comic-Con, the big comics and pop culture convention in San Diego every year. Directors are talking directly to their fans. They keep blogs, some of them. But this was incredibly rare when Peter started doing this back in 1998. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I think a lot of the way that fans and people in the industry interact now is to a large extent based on what Peter pioneered. So he really won over a lot of people in that way.
So he would show them what they were doing, show them design, and essentially bring them in early in the process to get comfortable with it. Did he also take their comments back and actually change parts of the design or the way he did things based on comments?
Well, I can't think of any of the design that would have been changed. It's certainly constantly rumored that he eliminated a proposed scene in which Arwen, the heroine, appears in battle gear at the big Battle of Helm's Deep in Part 2. That was talked about very widely on the Internet. People were up in arms. They could not stomach the idea of that big a change in the plot. And indeed, it was cut out. Now, whether that was due to fan pressure or it was just decided that that was a bad idea, we don't know. But one has to suspect that certainly the fans had some influence at various points.
Well, that brings me to the next question. I mean, let's look at what happened to the narrative of the books. Even though the Lord of the Rings trilogy is a very long movie when you put all three together, it still can't cover the same ground as the three-volume Tolkien trilogy, the books. So what techniques did they use to create the simplified complexity, as you call it?
Well, I think certainly creating a more conventional love story for Arwen and Aragorn. At least they assumed that would bring in a female audience. They were very concerned about getting women in to see this film because it was seen as a boys' movie, you know. They certainly did things like, I think in some ways, putting Gimli and Merry and Pippin as sort of comic relief figures simplifies them a bit and makes them, again, a sort of more conventional figure. You know, comic relief is such a common thing in Hollywood films. And, of course, some characters were cut out entirely. Elrond has twin sons, and you wouldn't know it from the film, mm-hmm. but you know, in the book, there they are. So I think it's partly just trimming of characters and partly making the story flow a little bit more in a conventional way than it does in the in the book.
Well, did they have to do special things in order to give each film what I'll call a satisfying shape and to be sure that someone could see part two without having seen part one, or did they not care about that?
Well, I think they do what television shows tend to do, which is to deliberately put some dialogue or action in at the beginning that doesn't really summarize what's happened already, but it kind of reiterates the main points. So someone coming into the Two Towers would know right away that Frodo's got this ring. The very first scene in which Frodo appears, he's talking about it, he's talking with Sam about, well, there's where we're trying to get to, and that's one place we can't get to. And so there are bits of dialogue that really sum up the situation in a very, very sketchy way, so that there was no attempt on the filmmaker's part to put in anything like a crawl title. You've got, in Star Wars, you've got the famous crawl title of Long, Long Ago in a Galaxy Far Away. Nothing like that in these films. Peter Jackson didn't want to use any kind of a crawl title, and ultimately he had his way. New Line was not able to talk him into using one. So I can imagine it might be a little difficult, actually, for people who had not seen, who had not read the books, to come into the films, and especially if they didn't start with the first film. People apparently do mostly follow the plot and keep the characters straight.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned that they were very concerned to get women into the theaters. Did they succeed?
Absolutely. It almost seems ludicrous now to look back on it and to think they were that worried about it, because if anything, there were more women going to the film than men. I don't think there are any absolute figures, but I went to a big fan convention, the One Ring Celebration, back in 2005, and I would say almost everyone there was women. I think it's partly the fact that you had these very handsome gentlemen playing roles. They weren't well-known actors at that time. I mean, Viggo Mortensen was known, but he wasn't a star in a real sense. So you get Viggo Mortensen and Elijah Wood and Orlando Bloom and so forth becoming stars, and matinee idols and teenage girls going back into the theaters, half a dozen times to see them. Mm-hmm. So the female element was there, I think. It's just that New Line didn't recognize it.
And I'm curious if this was even across the movies, and I ask that because my wife disliked the second movie considerably.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And did you notice that when you talked to women or interviewed people? Was there any correlation like that?
Well, the only correlation I've noticed is that people who know the books well tend not to like the second film as much as the other two.
Hmm.
People who have never read the books seem to like it as well, if not better. And I don't really have an explanation for that.
Hmm. This is Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Kristen Thompson. We're talking about the production of the three movies in the Lord of the Rings cycle, and our focus is on how DVDs, video games, and other ancillary movie tie-ins have affected the content and the form of movies. And I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area, or if you're anywhere else in North America, call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. So in your book, you argue that The Rings was on the cutting edge of the new technologies used to distribute and market films. And you've talked about it a little bit, but can you give me some more examples of what you mean by this?
Well, certainly the use of the Internet was pioneering. The Internet had been used to promote individual films for a few years before the first film's website went up. But it was still a fairly uncommon thing for a film to have its own website. And this one was very innovative, giving away all these images, wallpapers, screensavers, and so on. And it succeeded as a website better than any had up to that point. It got more people in a shorter amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part of it. There's also the DVDs, which we're just coming in at that point. I mean, DVDs are as recent as 1997 as a product,
mm-hmm.
and the first one of the Rings films came out in 2002. So DVDs were still a sort of minority product at that point. VHS was still very big. And Lord of the Rings, along with the Matrix films, were really major, major causes of people deciding finally to go ahead and buy DVD players, and they helped in that way to to foster the changeover from VHS to DVD, which the studio certainly wanted to see happen.
Well, let's take a look at that. I mean, they pioneered other ways to build the Lord of the Rings franchise. One of the ways that New Line Cinemas did was they used something called I'll Sell Your Brand If You Sell Mine. And can you give us an example of this?
Yeah, that's not a brand new concept, and it's called brand partnering.
Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of thing you get with the more famous cases going back into the 80s where Walt Disney teams up with McDonald's and they just promote each other's stuff in their advertising.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, products, little toys are given away in the meals and so forth. This is, I think, more and more becoming important for films because basically what they do is sign up with a bunch of big companies with brand names, well-recognized brand names, and those companies agree to take out a certain amount of advertising, and we're talking tens of millions of dollars in advertising, which will be for both products. So you have a certain brand of car in some kinds of films, like I forget what brand it was, but the new James Bond film was linked with a car, and so you would see the car and the reference to the film in the ad. So this is somewhat the same kind of thing that happened with Lord of the Rings. A bunch of these brand partners were brought in, some of them more logical than others.
Mm-hmm.
One of the ones that didn't really work was Burger King.
Mm-hmm.
There was Burger King tie-in for the first film, Fellowship of the Ring, and that got a lot of the fans rather upset, to say the least. There was a lot of criticism of that on the Internet, and basically, it didn't work very well. The deal fell through, and Burger King was no longer a brand partner by part two of the film. But there were other brand partnerships that worked very well. Air New Zealand is the one I talk about in the book,
mm-hmm.
and that was a sort of, I suppose, seen as a logical brand partnership because New Zealand was trying literally to rebrand itself through Lord of the Rings. That was a government policy. And the national airline, Air New Zealand, put these giant pictures of the film characters on four of its airplanes and advertised itself as the airline to Middle Earth. So they were providing all this advertising that partly was going to advertise Lord of the Rings. And they would show they'd show trailers on their planes in flight. They gave out postcards and so on. So, yeah, there was a lot of the advertising got paid for by other companies.
Now, you mentioned also that JVC created a tie-in DVD player.
Yeah.
Did that work to sell DVD players?
I think it probably did, yeah. It wasn't that the player itself was all that different, but it came in a box that had Lord of the Rings images on the outside, and it came packed with a DVD with little previews of the film. So that was, again, a way of slipping advertising for, you know, the player, slipping advertising into the for the film into that product. So this is a reciprocal sort of deal.
Now, on DVDs, we often see now making of documentaries. In fact, I was just watching one, oddly enough, on Police Squad, the TV show from the 80s. And when I watch them, they seem like an afterthought and a nice addition. But you're really claiming that to build the franchise, that these making of need to come out before the movie. Can you explain how this worked and what they did for Lord of the Rings?
Well, yeah. The phenomenon of cable television, which grew up in the 80s and 90s, meant that there was a lot of airtime that needed to be filled. And one way that now it's filled quite regularly is with these making-of documentaries. So a lot of cable stations will run ones that are sort of relevant to their own specialized interests. So Sci-Fi Channel will obviously run making-ofs for sci-fi films and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, what New Line did was to hire two different people to do those supplements that would go onto the DVDs and onto television. So there are a lot of making-ofs for Lord of the Rings. But I think in some ways the ones that were the most revolutionary were the ones that went onto the extended DVD supplements. Those were two discs each, which I think was probably unprecedented at that time. I mean, it was, if you bought that box, you got two discs that were the film, then all of the other material on the other two discs was supplements.
Mm-hmm.
And there's something like 20 hours of material on there, plus all these stills galleries.
Kristen, I've seen all of it because we had friends staying with us, and they watched all of it. yeah, I thought it a little redundant. I don't know what your reaction was. But anyways, it was an extensive DVD with the making of video on it, right?
Yeah. There's also been a more recent set of the DVDs that were put out last August, so it's just about a year ago. The company brought out all the films again. Each box has the theatrical and the extended edition and a DVD which has a feature-length documentary on the making of by yet another filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got three sets of supplements now, sold with three different sets of the DVDs, and it's just it's seen as a big bonus.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the fans adore these things; they go through them and
that's correct.
Know them backwards and forwards.
So, Lord of the Rings also brought something called EPKs, just state-of-the-art perfection. What's an EPK?
EPK stands for Electronic Press Kit, and again, I'm not sure this would have been the first film to have them, but certainly Gordon Pattison, who's the head of the Interactive Marketing Division at New Line, so he runs their website, but also he was trying to find a way of sending out material to the press that would not involve so much postage. I mean, that's one of the big costs of marketing is to put up these big packages of 8x10 photos and booklets and so on, and send them out to a bunch of reporters. So what he did was just he put the stuff on a floppy and sent that out. It was much cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
But then eventually, recordable CDs came along, and now any film will have an EPK. And the ones for Lord of the Rings were quite elaborate, as you can imagine, more so than a typical film would
mm-hmm.
warrant.
And I think you mentioned in the book that this is the first movie to have its own IT department, information technology department.
Well, according to the guy who ran that department, Duncan Nimmo,
mm-hmm.
As far as he knows, yeah, it was the first one.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at what I'll call the beginning of any film. I mean, after you have the idea, and that's money. And you note that Lord of the Rings is an independent film, and one usually associates this with a small budget and an art house kind of distribution. Yet Lord of the Rings is almost the opposite of this. I mean, what does Hollywood mean by an independent film?
Well, I think within Hollywood there are probably a variety of definitions. The one I took was the one from the American Film Market, which is the big place where independent films are traded, bought and sold. It's somewhat like Cannes, only much less glamorous, and it takes place in Santa Monica. Their definition of an independent film is any film that has 51% or more of its underwriting, of its financing, come from outside the studios. And virtually all of Lord of the Rings financing came from outside the studios. The traditional way that an independent film gets made, and this is whether it's a very small one or a big one, is that the distribution rights are sold in advance. And so a lot of money goes into the coffers even before the film is made.
So in advance of the movie being made at all, they have these. Now, in a studio movie, the studios might have funds or be able to leverage loans or something. And here you're saying they're actually selling something, the distribution rights, in advance. And that's the fundamental difference between a studio film and an independent film in your definition.
Yeah, that's basically it. And quite a bit of the money for Lord of the Rings was also raised by selling the ancillary rights. So, Toy Biz did the action figures, and they signed that contract back in 2000, which is more than a year before Fellowship came out.
Now, when they're pre-selling these local distribution rights, and I assume that's country by country, region by region, was this such an obvious thing that it was an easy sell, or did these people get the local distribution rights fairly cheap for the size movie that it was?
Well, they're reluctant, of course, to talk about actual figures, but I think they paid quite a bit. That was they ultimately signed up 26 companies. And some of these were companies they had been dealing with regularly. Some of them, that territory was open, and so they had to work a little harder and find someone to distribute in, say, Japan, Italy. Those were companies they didn't have regular distribution for. But some of these companies were paying, in the neighborhood of $6, $7, $8 million each to secure the rights to these films. And it added up to, depending on whom you listen to, somewhere in the neighborhood of 60 to 70% of the whole budget coming from these 26 distributors. And New Line, in fact, was boasting at the time as to how little money they actually put into the production of the film.
Well, we think of selling the film rights as a kind of a meeting in a room somewhere, but they use some very novel techniques to really involve these distributors. Can you tell me kind of the dog and pony shows that they ran and what it is that, that New Line and Peter Jackson did?
Yeah. These were mostly people who had already signed up to distribute the films, although in some cases it was a territory where they were still trying to sell the rights. But they would fly these people down to New Zealand, which is no short journey, as I can attest. And they would show them around the facilities. I mean, if you've seen the supplements, you know that Weta Workshop, for example, is just a wonderful place where they turn out the designs, the armor. They built the ants. They built all those miniatures that show up in the film. And that's a wonderful place to tour around. And anyone who goes in there comes out impressed. So, and Weta, of course, were working early on, them being designers, they had been working from the beginning of pre-production, and they had a lot of stuff to show for it. So when these distributors start coming down, they get toured around, they see the elven armor, they see the miniatures, these incredibly detailed miniatures. And then they're shown Weta Digital, where they have all their ranks of processors churning out you know, these incredible special effects. They get to meet the cast members, etc. They one of the things that was used during those tours was the artwork of the two artists I mentioned, Alan Lee and John Howe. Those would be put up as a sort of gallery chronologically in order through the film, and people would just be taken along that corridor and shown these beautiful images, and you know, they'd see the film in miniature as they went through and just be pretty bowled over. I mean, people always went away impressed.
This is The Afternoon Magazine, and I'm Bill Hammack. I'm talking with Kristen Thompson, author of the Frodo franchise, The Lord of the Rings in Modern Hollywood. I invite you to call with your questions at 333-WILL if you're in the area or anywhere else. Call me at 800-222-WILL. That's 333-9455. And 800-222-9455. Well, I want to take a look at the film itself. In talking about the development of the Lord of the Rings franchise, you reveal a lot about how the movie was made, and I think you were able to interview the director, Peter Jackson, and some 70-plus people associated with the film, and so you really got a bird's-eye view of how the film was made. Now, you quote Jackson, the director, in your book as saying, if you were entrusting $270 million to someone making three movies, you wouldn't choose me, and you would not choose a small New Zealand digital effects company, yet this project, against all common sense, got itself made. So who entrusted him, and why did they entrust a director like Jackson with only a few minor films under his belt to direct all three of these movies at once?
Well, originally the project was not for three movies. It was for two. The reason that that happened was that Peter Jackson had a connection with Miramax Films. Miramax had distributed Heavenly Creatures, and they also had made a film for Saul Zantz, who at that time owned the production rights for Lord of the Rings.
So Heavenly Creatures was one of Peter Jackson's films that he
directed.
Right,
yes. That came out in 1994. And, in fact, he and his partner, Fran Walsh, were nominated for Oscars for the screenplay for that. So that was one little bit of prestige reputation that Peter had at the time. But at any rate, he had this connection, a sort of, you know, he was supposed to take any new project to them for, you know, yes or no. And he said he wanted to do Lord of the Rings. They set out to make a two-film version, and that got quite far along. That was in pre-production for 18 months.
And were they just going to do the first two books or condense all three books into two films?
Condense all three books, into two films. So it was just going to be shorter. There was going to be no Lothlorien at all. You know, Galadriel would not appear, etc. Mm-hmm. They would have just cut more, basically. And they did come up with a complete script and all. They were well along into it. And then Michael Eisner at Disney decided that this was a foolish project. He didn't want to have any part of it, but you know, they were contracted to produce it, so he said, okay, we'll produce it as a two-hour single film with a low budget. It was, I think, $75 million. And Peter just couldn't see doing that. I mean, you know, sort of dashing his hopes. So he was assuming he was going to be off the project, but his agent convinced people at Miramax to allow him to shop it around to other studios over a three-week period, and New Line was the only studio that wanted to look at the stuff. Nobody wanted to take on fantasy because it was a sort of a despised genre at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But New Line not only took it on, but the president of the company, Bob Shea, said, you know, there are three books, let's make three films. So it really was his idea to make the three, because I think Peter would never have believed he could be optimistic enough to think that, you know, somebody would suggest such a thing. But Bob Shea did and undertook it. That was 1998, and at that point they started selling these rights to the distributors, selling the ancillary rights, the licenses to make the products. And so by the time the film was actually in principal photography, they had already assembled a lot of the money they needed.
And so is it only apparent that it's odd or lacks common sense to have Peter Jackson? Was he really a very logical choice?
Well, I'm not quite sure why Harvey Weinstein at Miramax wanted to entrust such a big project, because he never had had a financially successful film, even though he made about half a dozen features. So it, in a way, Harvey Weinstein taking a chance on him was somewhat illogical, but I guess they knew each other, and I guess Weinstein respected him, and Heavenly Creatures is a very good film, even though it didn't make money. But then when Peter had this three-week period when he was shopping the film around to other studios, in effect, he controlled the rights to make The Lord of the Rings. He didn't own them, but he controlled them, and if he could find another studio, he could bring them those rights into that new studio, which is what happened. And in a way, Bob Shea was just saying to himself, here's this wonderful property, this very famous novel that I, you know, could make a fortune on, and let's make it into a franchise.
But it's still, Jackson had really made kind of low-budget splatter films early on. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. They're pretty gross, all right. I mean, they're very bloody. I mean, they're humorous at the same time, but certainly not to everyone's taste.
And so,
I think Heavenly Creatures was the only thing that he had made that would have had a bit more prestige about it.
Mm-hmm. And what qualities did Jackson then bring to the making of the film, and what kind of
extensive control? And that's, I think, to a large extent because he was able to convince New Line to let him make the film in New Zealand. And I think a lot of people don't realize that every foot of film that was shot, every object that was made, with the very small exception of some of the contact lenses that were used, everything was made in New Zealand, and most of it by Kiwis. So he was working on his home turf. His home turf was a 13-hour flight away from New Line's headquarters in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
They had one producer on the scene, Mark Ordesky, who was very much a friend of Peter's and sort of on his side, as it were. So he was, you know, willing to let Peter get away with things. So, yeah, Peter had a great deal of control over the filmmaking, and he also commands a huge loyalty from all the people that he works with, so that anytime some kind of dispute between Peter and New Line would come up, everyone who was working on the film would be on his side, and he often got his way.
Now, you mentioned that he even would kind of micromanage and approve the dubbed voices on foreign language editions. Is that usual for a film director to do that?
No, I don't think so. I mean, it may happen occasionally, but certainly a filmmaker who is working down to the wire the way he was on each of these films and who has so many things to think about, you know, little details of costumes to pass on and that sort of thing. And he still took the time to do this. So, yeah, he very much, well, he's a perfectionist, and he really, I think, really cares.
So let's take a look at just a few of the, maybe even just one of the technical aspects of the film, because your book is filled with these, and we could talk forever. But I was a little bit curious, how were the colors produced in the film? Because it has a very interesting look to it.
Yeah, that was one of the main technical innovations of the film, actually. This process is called digital grading. I mean, grading of photography is determining the types of colors, you know, tweaking, in effect, the colors and, you know, light levels and so forth in a film image after it's been shot. That typically used to be done in the lab, chemically. But more recently, with the digital revolution, technology has been evolved that will do that process automatically. And it was used for Pleasantville, for example, if you remember that film where some of the images had black and white people in color environments or vice versa. Mm-hmm. That was one of the innovative films that used that sort of thing. Digital color grading was used in O Brother, Where Art Thou? To give it that sort of yellowish autumnal look.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing about Lord of the Rings is that the people who devised the program that was used for the grading managed to innovate in such a way that they could just do part of a frame very easily. They could select one portion of the frame, change the color in that, and the rest of the frame would stay the same. And then the computer would automatically do that same procedure for each frame of that shot, which makes it a lot easier.
And can you describe a shot where they did that and how maybe it affected, how we reacted to the shot?
Well, I suppose the most famous one is The Death of Boromir, because you get a close-up of Sean Bean's face as Boromir is dying, and there's this tiny, tiny, very subtle fading of, flesh color to gray. And if you don't know it's there, you probably just notice it subliminally, but it definitely, marks the moment of his death. They also, the filmmakers talk about how in the Moria sequences, they wanted the characters' faces to look gray and washed out, and as if there's no, sunlight or any kind of warmth in that place. And again, they took the characters' flesh tones and changed them just a bit to make them more muted. But there are other cases where brighter colors were added, as in a lot of the Shire scenes. I think, many of those beautifully yellow-green fields that you see in the Shire have been enhanced a bit by that process.
And you point out in the book, I want to look now a little bit at the viewing and the distribution. You point out in the book that there are many DVD versions of Lord of the Rings, and we've discussed those a little bit. And I assume this is because they want people to continue to buy Lord of the Rings again and again and again. There's extended versions and high def and added footage. So you point out in the book that Hollywood really wants us to buy DVDs rather than rent them. Can you go over the numbers and tell us why this is?
Well, the main one is that DVDs just cost so little to make in comparison with VHS tapes that they're inevitably more profitable. It takes, they are not making VHS tapes in very many regions anymore, but you have to record a VHS tape in real time. So there would be all these machines cranking through, recording 2 hours or whatever.
So if it's a two-hour movie, it takes 2 hours to make that videotape.
Yeah, and of course that's compounded by thousands and thousands. So mm-hmm. it's a fairly elaborate procedure, whereas these DVDs are just stamped out very quickly one by one. And the material costs very little. I think it's less than $2 to actually physically make and package a DVD.
Mm-hmm.
So if somebody's paying $16 for it in the store, typically what happens is the studio is going to make somewhere around $10 or $11 on that DVD.
And it's interesting, the breakdown of the numbers, you report, like you said, a little under $2 for packaging and production and 80 cents for distribution, and the big amount is $2.75 for marketing the DVD, and still leaving a profit of $10 or $11 on the DVD.
Yeah, I think when I was saying $16, I probably should have said $24, which is more what they started out charging for DVDs. Now, of course, the prices have fallen somewhat, but even so, I mean, when you think $10 or $11 profit on a maybe $20 item, it's pretty absurd.
Well, let's look at the effect of Lord of the Rings on movie making. The much of movie making has become digital, as you noted, and this has changed or can change, I guess, where filmmaking occurs. Did it allow New Zealand to become a film center?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the one big factor, is that suddenly, through Peter Jackson's investments, the investments of his colleagues, they had this incredible facility down there, Weta Digital, which is probably one of the top three effects houses in the world.
So they have actually built buildings, and it still exists down there?
Oh, yeah. It's all there. I'm trying to think. Let's see. iRobot was partly some of the special effects for that were done at Weta Digital. I think quite a few of the shots in the third X-Men movie were shot there, the giant battle at Alcatraz. Well, not shot, but the special effects were done there. So, yes, they're very much a working facility. And with over 4,000 processors and hundreds of employees, and it's not quite industrial light and magic, but it's in that league.
And it's not called Hollywood. It's called, what is the name for it?
Well, they call it Williwood because, Wellington, New Zealand, but okay. It's in the suburb of Miramar.
Mm-hmm. So this allows, though, these digital communications and having the movie made digitally allows one to set up a production facility elsewhere and communicate as Jackson did with New Line Cinemas, right?
Yeah, he was in London for big stretches of the post-production. He was working with Howard Shore on recording the soundtrack while Peter was sitting at his hotel editing and so on. He'd run back and forth. And he could also have full-scale meetings with groups of his post-production supervisors who were in Wellington, but through this system that they referred to as the fat pipe, this closed broadband system, they were able to send streaming video back and forth and to actually see each other while they were talking from London to Wellington and back, gesture at each other and so forth, and hold a meeting.
So, Kristen, we have a caller in Champaign, so I'd like to go to the caller from line one.
Yeah, hi. Mm-hmm. I didn't interrupt. The interviewing's been so good, so I thought I'd just, this could be a little break. Usually, movies, for the people that didn't read the book, usually movies have an impact on the sales of the book. Did you track that at all or not?
Yes. This film had an enormous impact on the original book's sales. I believe in 2002 it sold something over 2 million copies, which is a lot. And Tolkien, as listed on the list of top-earning dead celebrities that Forbes runs every year, Tolkien went from number 7 to number 3.
That's something to aspire to, yeah.
His publisher was very happy.
Mm-hmm. And the other one is that I remember with the Star Wars that, especially these young kids at that time, and I don't know whether that this film had the same impact, but a lot of these kids went numerous times. It was like how many could pay it again and again and again to go to it. And so, do you know whether this phenomenon occurred with this film or not?
Oh yeah, at least as much. I remember the first time I saw it, which was actually about a month after it premiered. I waited till the first big rush was over, and I went into a theater in the afternoon to watch Fellowship of the Ring. And there were these two high school girls behind me, obviously skipping school. One of them was saying, this is the sixth time she had seen it. And that's six times in one
Very
month.
Very good interview.
She probably went again.
All right, thank you. Kristen, we only have a little over a minute left, and I kind of wanted to summarize your book or draw a conclusion from it or have you do that. Your book is really an extended study of film franchises, and you're looking at a film as a center of a nexus of activity. Do you see film now becoming, because of this, so commercialized that it blends into kind of a mishmash of branded products and ceases to have a cultural identity?
No, I don't, actually. I think there's a certain group of films that's treated this way. Every studio wants a big franchise or two, but they're still making films by, Spike Lee and Tim Burton and the people who were making films back in the days before franchises became so important. So we're still getting individual films that aren't marketed in that same way, and we're getting the little art house films. We're seeing, in fact, probably more art house films get distribution now than before this all started. So, no, I think there's quite a bit of diversity within film releases.
All right, well, we're at the end of our time. Kristen, thanks for taking the time to chat.
Well, thank you.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Kristen Thompson, author of The Frodo Franchise, The Lord of the Rings in Modern Hollywood. The technical director for the segment was Jason Croft, and the producer was Harriet Williamson.